This is On Target St. John's, a look at politics, crime, education. What's happening here with the people who know? The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station. Now, your On Target St. John's host, Linda Swain.
Earlier this week, the Newfoundland and Labrador Association for Community Living issued a release outlining what they call their roadmap for reform when it comes to supported decision-making in Newfoundland and Labrador. Supported decision-making, and our guests will go into that a little bit further, involves allowing a designated person to convey and express the legal rights of a person with an intellectual disability or other type of disability. This is an issue we've discussed on Target before, and here to provide an update is Right to Decide Steering Committee Chair Ray McIsaac. He's in Stephenville. Hi, Ray.
Hi, how are you today?
Great. An adjunct professor at Ryerson University, a managing director of the Institute for Research and Development on Inclusion and Society, Dr. Michael Bach. Hello.
Hello there. Good to join you.
Thanks for joining us. Ray, we'll start with you, I guess. What was the purpose of this week's news release?
Well, it coincided with the release of an independent consultant's report, which Michael was leading, which affirmed that discrimination exists in the province against people with intellectual, developmental, and cognitive disabilities, and those people who are living with mental health issues. So it affects the rights of persons with disabilities to live in the community, because it is really quite difficult to do that if there are barriers to making personal life decisions, healthcare, financial decisions, opening a bank account, getting an MCP card, changing your address, getting access to your medical records, and a host of other kinds of issues. And the concern overall, I guess, is that this is a bedrock foundation to making it practical for people to live in the community and not prematurely entering into long-term care facilities, or particularly for younger people with disabilities, ending up in long-term care for seniors at early ages of 35 and 40 years old, because there are a lack of alternatives and choices in the community.
Dr. Michael Bach, he referenced your report. What exactly did it find?
So this report results from effectively a two-year study. And what we looked at, we started with the concern that has been expressed by the community, as Ray has outlined, people being denied the right to make a whole range of decisions in their lives. And essentially, the study looked at, well, so why is this happening? What's going on? And so the study effectively kind of looks from the top down and the bottom up, if you will. It looks at the legal framework in the province, as well as provincial public policies, and then also looks at the experience of people in communities and from the perspective of families, as well as community service providers. And what we find is that across a core set of laws in the province, you find this distinction in law, which recognizes that, or provides that, people have to have a certain level of mental capacity, independent decision-making skills, in order to be recognized as a person who can exercise what's called in the law legal capacity. But effectively, that's decision-making power, the right to enter a contract, to give informed consent to a physician, to make a personal decision, sign a lease with a landlord, or sign an employment contract. And so there's a growing group of people who don't meet that test of being able to understand and appreciate and make a decision on their own. And the reason is, we're seeing an increasing proportion of people with intellectual and cognitive and developmental disabilities, and people living with mental health issues in our population. And in Newfoundland and Labrador has the one of the fastest aging of the populations in the country. And that's not a bad thing. Having an aging population is not a bad thing. It means you've got a growing proportion of people in the community who bring years of experience and skills and wisdom, and who can have more time if they're no longer in the paid labor market to contribute to their families and communities. So there's all kinds of benefits to an aging society. Along with that comes the fact that people need support. Cognitive decline is associated with aging. So there's an important policy choice to be made. In the status quo legal framework, it means that as more and more people aren't able to make that meet that test, if you will, of what it means to exercise decision-making power or legal capacity, the policy choice is, do we put a growing number of people under guardianship, under substitute decision-making, basically giving over to the public trustee or some other authority in the state or personal guardians the authority to make decisions for a person?
Is that what's happening now? That's how it is?
And that's what's happening.
Okay.
So we're seeing an increase in the number of people who are being placed under guardianship because a growing number of people don't have the cognitive capacities. So, and that, I think, has really significant implications. And this is an issue not only for Newfoundland and Labrador, but, you know, across Canada and around the world. But so the policy choice is, what do we do here? Do we put more and more and more of us under the authority of others to make decisions for us? There's a problem with that, though, because we associate making a decision and guiding your own life as pretty basic, pretty fundamental to what it means to be a human being and to be have dignity and respect in the eyes of others. The alternative is what's called supported decision making. And that means having a person who can bring assistance to you. And that assistance could be any number of things. It could be someone who advocates for you when you go to the bank, if someone's not able to or is uncomfortable about doing that on their own. It could be, and we know with people with more significant intellectual or cognitive disabilities, who may communicate through gestures and ways of communicating that most others don't understand, the assistance from a supporter could be helping interpret what their expressions mean as the basis for decision making. And so what this emerging alternative supported decision making is beginning to get recognized in law, in some bits and pieces in Newfoundland and Labrador, and more extensively in some other jurisdictions. And what it provides then is that I don't lose my legal capacity in the eyes of the law. What I get instead, by having a substitute decision maker appointed, what I get instead is having the assistance. It could be a son, a daughter, brother, sister, parent, friend, who's designated under the law to assist me to make decisions. And that maintains my dignity and respect in the eyes of the bank, in the eyes of the healthcare provider, and assures that I continue to have an equal place in our society.
Who appoints this assistant decision maker, and how can we ensure that they're making the right decisions, if you will, that their motivation is altruistic and genuine?
So there are different ways of doing it, depending on the jurisdiction. It could be a court appointment. You could go to court to get that person appointed. That may be cumbersome and expensive. There are jurisdictions, British Columbia, for example, provides that people can make that appointment themselves. If I have a significant intellectual disability and I'm not able to make that appointment, there can be arrangements where the supporter applies to be recognized as that designated person, and either through a tribunal or a court or the public trustee's office, and on the basis that they have a relationship of, you know, a long-term relationship of personal trust, knowledge, and commitment to the person. The legal framework for this would lay out the duties of those decision-making supporters. So they would be legally obligated to provide support that respects the will and the preferences of that person, that doesn't do anything to undermine the interests of that person. And there's some examples in the legislation in British Columbia, in Yukon, that lay out what those duties are. And where things are really vulnerable, if a person's really vulnerable or there are concerns by the public trustee's office, let's say, that there may be a situation of neglect here, or supporters, you know, need support in order to play that role, you can appoint a monitor to help kind of monitor the situation for financial, to make sure things are financially being managed well, or the person's preferences are being respected in decision making. So there are those kinds of safeguards that would need to be in place. But this is already a concern. I mean, we know in Newfoundland and Labrador, you know, powers of attorney are another mechanism, but they're not actually available to people with more significant intellectual or cognitive disabilities. And there are concerns about, you know, financial abuse under powers of attorney. There are concerns about, and people under substitute decision making or guardianship. These are long-standing concerns. So this issue of how we're going to respect the will and preferences of people who are vulnerable in a number of ways, who need support to make decisions, and to make sure that the supporters are accountable and that people aren't placed at risk, is an issue that we have to face one way or the other.
My guest today, if I may, I'll just pause you there, but my guest today on Target are Right to Decide Steering Committee Chair Ray McIsaac and Managing Director of the Institute for Research and Development on Inclusion and Society, Dr. Michael Bach. We're talking about supported decision making. We'll be back right after this.
Now back to Linda Swain on Target St. John's on VOCM.
And we're back. We're talking about supported decision-making in Newfoundland and Labrador. And earlier this week, the Newfoundland and Labrador Association for Community Living issued a release outlining what they call their roadmap for reform when it comes to supported decision-making. And Ray, I'm going to bring you back into the conversation now. Does decision on how this works in law, does it fall under federal or provincial jurisdiction?
Well, people are affected by both federal and provincial laws, but the regulation of legal capacity is generally within the provincial scope. So we have been working, and by we, I mean almost all of the major organizations of persons with disabilities and seniors have been working for approximately 10 years with the provincial government to scope out solutions to this problem that Michael just articulated. I should say that in 10 years of doing that, I haven't met a single person out of thousands of people who didn't agree with the fundamental premise behind what this report suggests. So we obviously want to move ahead with the report. The community is strongly behind this. I think that it's clear and obvious that everybody in this province is touched by this issue, because we're probably talking about, 20% of the population, but any person at any time could be, for instance, have a stroke, or, will age and will come into these issues, or could be a caregiver to a son or daughter, and you have people with disabilities themselves who initiated the call for these reforms. The if I might speak to the actual place where we go from here, is that appropriate at this time?
Sure. But I wanted to ask you just a generic kind of question now. How do we compare to other jurisdictions? Who's getting it right and who's falling behind?
I think we have an opportunity to lead the country, but I think our laws are for the most part very very archaic and trace back to laws and a legal system that was developed in the 1840s, 1850s, and reflect an attitude towards people with disabilities as not being fully human in that era, and our laws have not changed substantially around core principles like guardianship. Now, we have more progressive and more recent legislation with things like the Adult Protection Act and so on that recognize the right of people to call upon supporters to help express their, you know, their opinions, their views, and whatever, if they have difficulty in doing that.
I'm up to another break, but when we come back, I do want to explore where you want to take this from here right after this.
Now back to Linda Swain on Target St. John's on VOCM.
And we're discussing supported decision-making in Newfoundland and Labrador. Ray McIsaac is with the Newfoundland and Labrador Association for Community Living. He's also on the Right to Decide Steering Committee. And Ray, where do you hope to take this from here?
Okay, so the consultant's report, IRIS's report, lays out the grounds for saying that the current laws in this province are discriminatory to people with disabilities. It also lays out a path to say that this is that we know how to address it, that it's doable, that it is not, you know, majorly disruptive to the existing legal framework in order to make this change so that all people could be included and nobody is marginalized because of the fact that they don't quite qualify at the same level as other citizens. So this being a political season, you know, we've asked and we'll be releasing a copy on Monday of a call to action for all political parties to respond to, which is fairly brief. There are 11 recommendations in the report that Michael refers to. The most important of those is the idea that nobody gets left behind. This includes all persons who, and particularly when we say all persons, we mean those people who most need the supports, the people who are at most risk of falling out of community life unless we find ways of supporting them, with people we could acknowledge who already are supporting people but are not legally acknowledged to do so, and finding ways for communities to put people next to people who are isolated, which is probably, again, about 20 or 25% of the people. So the first ask is the adoption of the report. The second one is community wants a seat at the table and to be a continued part of a collaboration that has been very successful and very rich to this point. The third platform, I guess, in the call to action is a request for funding. It's a modest ask of $600,000 for each year for 3 years to develop some pilot projects which would prove up or demonstrate the community's capabilities to be able to provide support and advice to people and to match people who are isolated to supporters and to help supported decision-making agreements be put in place and to help people develop life plans to help parents of or primary caregivers of people to work with people with disabilities to plan for the future, to make financial provision, and so on. So the third ask is, you know, it really amounts to the cost of perhaps one person in crisis could easily cost what putting this infrastructure in place at a pilot level would cost. And for what's offered here is the fundamental idea is that government itself cannot provide the solutions to all people, particularly where we have, you know, people who need 24/7 supports and so on. Families don't have the means in and of themselves, but the community is rich with resources in terms of family, extended family, organizations, people, volunteers, people who do good work and who really know how to get stuff done. So both in the Southwest Coast region and the Avalon region, for the last year or so, work has been ongoing at the community level to try to organize to be ready for top-down legal reform at the local community level so that law reform doesn't end up not helping people at the local community level. And so what he's asked for is that all parties would agree to fund a proposal that's currently in the system and shared with various parties for that $1.8 million ask, which is over 3 years, to mobilize local communities.
I understand other groups are on board with this as well. You have the Autism Society, for instance, that's also very interested in this.
The Autism Society has been working with us at the local community level. At a provincial steering committee level, we have the Consumers Organization of Persons with Disabilities, Channel, Canadian Mental Health Association, Seniors NL, People First Newfoundland and Labrador, the Newfoundland and Labrador Association for Community Living, and sorry to leave anybody out, but there are a host of people involved in weekly conference calls ever since COVID came into place, working towards these goals. This is seen as exceedingly important on the whole agenda of how seniors remain in their own homes, how that practically happens, and it's a human rights issue, of course, in terms of respecting the full humanity and rights and equal protection under the law for persons with disabilities and seniors. You don't lose it because you develop dementia, as an example. So this whole regime is about keeping individuals at the center of decision-making around their lives, even when people perhaps lose some cognitive skills, but then can rely upon people who know and understand them to help support them navigate their communities.
Dr. Michael Bach, where is supported decision-making currently happening, and how is it working?
So we see supported decision-making happening in British Columbia. It's been recognized, and I would say that's probably the most inclusive system in the country. In some other provinces, in Alberta, for example, there is supported decision-making recognized, but only for people who meet that test of cognitive capacity to appoint and basically make decisions on their own. And we did put that option into the on the table in our report. So that's one option that can be considered. The community, when we prepared the report, we circulated a penultimate draft to both government officials as well as to the community. And the community wrote back a very clear response that they felt that option should not be adopted because it's too restrictive. It's not fully inclusive of people with more significant intellectual disabilities and cognitive disabilities, and they want to see supported decision making for all. We're beginning to see it adopted in different jurisdictions at the state level, in the U.S., in Australia. It's beginning to see pieces of it in Europe. So this is really a global phenomenon. Our institute's just been commissioned actually by the Supreme Court of Mexico to do an international comparison of how this is evolving across the world, because the constitutional court cases challenging current guardianship laws are showing up in courts around the world. So this is really a global phenomenon. And really comes from people with disabilities who have been calling for change. This was one of the priority issues that is front and center in the UN Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities that was adopted and ratified by Canada, just about a decade ago.
And for family members as well. One would think that if, you have a loved one for whom you've been caring and know that that's becoming more difficult or worried about what happens when you pass on, you don't want them necessarily to be under some form of guardianship and make law, justices of the peace make these decisions for them.
That's one of the really strong themes that comes out of the study is that families feel pushed into a corner. They don't actually have alternatives. So they have to take out guardianship because there are property interests, there are healthcare interests, but it becomes a catch-22. In the interests of protecting their sons and daughters or brothers and sisters and making sure that their needs can be met, they have to become their guardians. And they don't actually want to be. They want an alternative that enables them to be able to support that family member just like they support any other family member who may not yet have lost cognitive abilities. So there needs to be, as we say in the report, and I think as Ray has mentioned, a top-down strategy, and the recommendations are to really start with this very archaic piece of legislation in the province, the Mentally Disabled Persons Estates Act, and restructure that act to recognize that support for decision-making is a valid way to go. And we see this in case law across the country. So there's a legal basis for this. It just hasn't found its way into law yet. And then also work, as Ray has said, at the community level from the bottom up to demonstrate how this can work in practice. Because one of the main ways in which people lose decision-making power over their lives is not necessarily through guardianship, but the legal framework has set up this distinction between those who are given full recognition of legal capacity and those who aren't. And we've adopted that in practice. We just assume when we look, when a person sees a person with an intellectual disability or a person who has had a stroke or a person who may have, you know, mental health issues, that they can't make decisions on their own and we have to step in and take over for them. And so this, for most people, this happens even outside of the law. It just happens as a matter of practice. So the law has really shaped how people are seen. You know, we've learned a lot in the last decade, and we hear leaders now talking about structural racism. This is about structural ableism. The law has really institutionalized structural ableism. Only certain people with certain kinds of abilities get recognized as equal. And there's a whole group that's being left behind.
Ray, we have less than a minute left. I guess timing is of the essence here. We're in the middle of a provincial election. Are you hoping to catch the ear of the various leaders?
Yes, that's the purpose of the call to action, is to give the opportunity for each of the parties to endorse the report and to continue to move along on the basis of the points that I had raised. I should add quickly that the Deputy Minister of Justice and Public Safety and the Deputy Attorney General recently issued some correspondence saying that the government of Newfoundland and Labrador affirms the right for all people to enjoy equal civil, political, economic, social, and cultural rights, thinking especially of Indigenous peoples and visible minorities, gender lens, and so on, set out in the UN Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities and the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms. She says that.
Okay, and unfortunately, Ray, we're out of time. We have network commitments, so we have to go. But I do appreciate the time for both of you. Ray McIsaac, the Right to Decide Steering Committee Chair and Managing Director of the Institute for Research and Development on Inclusion in Society. Dr. Michael Bach, thank you both.
Thanks.
Thank you.